Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Friday, March the 15th, 2024. And we continue on with our podcast series featuring the Seat Working Papers by Seat President Laura Snyder. Today we are going to be talking about paper number 11. And obviously, I am joined by Karen Alpert in Australia. And of course, Laura Snyder in Paris. And, how are each of you today?
Hi, John. Huh. Doing okay.
We're fine.
Just fine. This is an exciting topic.
It is. It is.
This is Working Paper 11, and the title here: Extraterritorial Taxation Number 11, Deference. Or constitutionalization, deference or constitutionalization. Don't know how great the title is here in previewing the content. Interesting question. Laura, what do you think here? What was the purpose of this particular working paper? Deference or constitutionalization? What's the difference anyway?
Well, those are two different questions. The purpose of this paper and what's the difference?
Well, let's start with the purpose of the paper. What's the purpose of the paper?
So this particular paper is part of, it's an excerpt of the larger article, Myths and Truths of Extraterritorial Taxation, that was published in the Cornell Journal of Law and Public Policy. And what motivated this particular section of that paper, and so this paper number 11 of our working paper series, is an article that was published in 2021 in the Duke Journal of Constitutional Law and Public Policy. And this article asked the question, should U.S. tax law be constitutionalized? And the author of this article argues that U.S. federal tax law should not be he basically argues that it should not be constitutionalized. That's the word he used. And what he means is subject to constitutional review by the Supreme Court. And he argues this not because he thinks that federal tax law should be exempt from equal protection scrutiny, but that he thinks that the Supreme Court is not up to the task. And that is why it should fall to Congress to assess tax laws against a constitutional equal protection standard.
Okay. Now, that definitely, Laura, now that is a mouthful. Okay. I wonder if we can just break it down a little more simply here, right? I mean, when somebody says that tax law cannot be constitutionalized, wouldn't the starting presumption be that there are no constitutional limits on what Congress can do in making tax laws?
Is that what would happen? Yeah. Basically what they're saying is the Supreme Court should not pronounce, have an opinion, or be allowed to give opinions on the constitutionalization, on whether or not a tax law is constitutional or not. That Congress should just be allowed to make that determination for itself. That's basically what they're arguing.
Okay, but isn't that the same thing as there's just simply no limit to taxation?
Yeah, because Congress is not going to limit itself.
So in other words, what the author of this paper is actually saying is
the paper that Laura's critiquing.
There should be absolutely no limit on tax laws that can be made up by the government. That's what I'm saying.
This author would say no, because Congress should place those limits. But the reality is that Congress does not place those limits. That's why you need a constitution. That's why you need an equal protection clause, because
need a court system too.
And that's why you need the court.
Okay, so let's break this down really, really simply. Okay, so the reason we have a constitution is the layout in the system of government of who can do what, correct?
And who has what rights? Well, yes.
Okay, and from that point, you know, you go to individual rights in some cases. But a constitution would in many cases limit what governments can do, right? Okay, so to say that tax law should not be constitutionalized is to begin the discussion with a presumption that there's absolutely no legal limit on tax laws that Congress can make, correct?
Absolutely. Only Congress can limit itself, but no one else can.
Right. And of course, the purpose of the Supreme Court, right, you know, the whole division of powers thing, right, is largely to provide a mechanism to protect the American people from Congress. Agree?
Absolutely.
All right. So in other words, what the article is actually saying is that the American people should have absolutely no protection from what tax laws can be made up by Congress, right? That's the starting point, isn't it?
Yep.
All right. Well, I mean, I think that's incredibly significant. So taxation without limits, it's all about taxation.
Yeah. And as John, you have told us many times, what you are going towards, if not we're already there, is that this makes the tax code the Constitution.
You're kidding. I've never heard that before.
Yo, yeah, you've never heard that before.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, my personal view is that the Internal Revenue Code is the Constitution of the United States because there are no, you know, there are no real limits on it. But I mean, what this paper is doing is saying, you know, it's giving the academic seal of good housekeeping on that principle that, of course, there should be no constitutional limits on tax laws, right?
Yeah, I got a couple things to say about that. So one thing is, what people will say to defend that point of view is they'll say yes, that a tax law should have special deference, because logically, this is exact words of one author, logically, any imposition of any tax is rationally related to raising revenue, which is a singular and uncontroversially legitimate end. And that's not true at all. Very few tax laws, certainly on the federal level, are about raising revenue. They're about encouraging behavior, discouraging other behaviors, punishing, but very rarely, if ever, are federal tax laws about raising revenue. So that premise, that very premise, is absolutely wrong. And even if it was about raising revenue, I don't know that violating people's fundamental rights is, you know, that should be a reason. Raising revenue is not a reason to violate rights. And I think that most people, if they were in a position of having their rights violated because it raised revenue, would agree with that. You don't go around with laws that penalize people based on race. You don't charge people extra money based on race. You could say, well, you get more money from that. Well, yeah, you do. But it violates their equal protection rights. So, you know, I think if you thought about it, it's quite obvious. But to some of these intellectuals writing about this in a theoretical vacuum, it apparently is not so obvious.
Well, they have trouble thinking about it. This is the problem, you know. Karen, what do you think about this? First of all, do you think that the Internal Revenue Code is the Constitution, in effect, the Constitution in the United States?
Well, in some sense, it's probably, yeah, it's above the Constitution. I mean, it's really hard to protect your rights when the tax law infringes on them.
Which means that normal constitutional protections, well, for example, you know, Fourth Amendment search and seizure and that, don't apply in the case of tax laws.
Right. And we see that with the garnishee rules, et cetera, but, you know, and tax liens.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So basically, I guess what I'm saying is that that in some sense, the Constitution has been superseded by the Internal Revenue Code.
Yeah, the Constitution, whatever rights and protections the Constitution may give normally do not apply once it's characterized as a tax issue. Maybe we put it that way, right?
Right.
So maybe the way to look at this is that sort of like, when it's taxation, anything goes. For everything else, there's the Constitution.
Sounds about right.
I like that.
You can channel a lot of stuff through the tax code. If as I said, the tax code is used to encourage behaviors, discourage other behaviors, punish people. So, you know, you can a lot of things that you wouldn't necessarily think are related to tax can be channeled through the tax code.
Well, you know, Laura, a number of your previous working papers that we've talked about here, you know, I think the general theme of animus towards Americans abroad, you know, that has reared its head in all kinds of these papers, hasn't it?
Yes. Well, that's what's going on underneath all of this. This feeling that Americans who live overseas are, you know, they live overseas for illegitimate reasons. All they are trying to do is avoid taxes. They're not fulfilling their whatever civic duties they have in the United States. This is what is underlies all of this is the animus.
Well, and I think this is also very much reflected by the fact that so many of these laws impacting Americans abroad come in as revenue offsets, right?
Yeah, that's right. Because we're the scapegoat. We're the scapegoats when they are looking to, you know, reduce taxes or increase expenditures for some other segment of the population. And they think that they need to compensate this with revenue somewhere else. We've seen in law after law that we are the scapegoats, where we're the ones who are supposed to make up for that revenue loss.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, we see this time after time. Of course, the whole thing is a fiction anyway. You know, as we know, both the revenue offsets. I mean, I think it's more symbolic than real, right? That these things come in as revenue offsets, which is also, I think, makes it a virtual certainty that none of these things are actually red. Maybe that's good.
Yeah, they'll put it in as a revenue offset, but do they go back 5-10 years later and say, did we actually get the revenue we thought we would get from this?
Well, you got to remember that. Remember what the buzz was with FATCA? $200
billion. It was $100 billion.
Was it 100?
$100 billion was the number in that report that Levin's office put out, that the U.S. was missing out on $100 billion of tax revenue. I don't know that any time frame was given for that. Like, was it $100 billion a year? I don't know what the time frame was.
Well, it was a totally made-up number anyways.
Of course it was a made-up number, and the reason it's credible is because of the presumption of the hatred of anything foreign, right?
What was really outrageous about that number is if you look at the footnotes that were purported to support that number. I have one of my papers. I think it was the criminalization of American immigrant or taxing the American immigrant. One of those papers, I look at those footnotes in detail. And so a lot of the footnotes were irrelevant to what they were supposed to be supporting. And then also what you discover if you look at those footnotes is that not a single one of the problems that were discussed in those footnotes had anything to do with Americans living outside the United States. Not a single one had anything to do with us evading taxes or with, you know, the need to make up tax revenue from us, or that, you know, revenue from us had anything to do with that $100 billion number. Nothing. Complete disconnect. But apparently, we still are supposed to be subjected to that.
Well, absolutely, because Americans abroad, by their very nature, erode the U.S. tax system, right? Yeah, it's truly amazing stuff. All right, so I mean, that's the broad issue here, right, that's being raised in the paper to which you refer. You know, should there be any limits to what Congress can do? Maybe, you know, pick it up from here. What should be added to this? You've got some discussion of equal protection.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well,
basically, there's, even before this 2021 article was published, there was, you know, already among certain intellectuals, this argument that court should give particular deference to tax laws because they're rationally related to raising revenue. And that's, that's uncontroversial, legitimate end. So we've already discussed that that's baloney. Now, what this 2021 article does is go one step further, and not only should courts give special deference to tax laws, but they shouldn't even be considering them. They should just give it up and let Congress decide for itself whether its own laws are constitutional or not, and in particular, whether they meet equal protection restrictions or not. And that is very dangerous, because Congress is never going to accept that any law that they pass violates equal protection, because then they wouldn't have passed it, right? I mean, it makes no sense. You've got to have someone else, some other body, you know, determine whether a law that a legislature adopts violates any constitutional provision, and certainly equal protection. The very reason why you need an equal protection clause is to protect people from the overreach of legislatures.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely correct. I mean, have you ever, I mean, my impression is that there's never any discussion, to the extent there's any discussion anyway, but to the extent there's any discussion, could you imagine somebody like Nancy Pelosi standing up and saying, well, we must consider whether this law violates equal protection?
No. And what's particularly interesting, specifically regarding Americans who live outside the United States, John, you'll remember that I think under the Carter administration, there was an attempt to set up some sort of commission or committee to commission anyway, to look at the situation of overseas Americans.
Yeah.
And they were supposed to look at, you know, how we're treated, whether the laws are fair and equitable with respect to taxation and other issues. And in 1982, those provisions were repealed. And the reason given for that was that they were obsolete. So apparently it's the idea that Congress should consider whether the laws affecting overseas Americans are fair and equitable. Apparently that very idea is obsolete. So this makes even more crazy the idea of saying, oh, you know, courts should not be allowed to review tax laws, in particular the laws that affect overseas Americans.
Well, I mean, in this particular case, the article saying, you know, tax laws above everything else wasn't really aimed overseas Americans. I mean, I think this is a problem for all Americans, right? I mean, what it really is, what this article really should be titled is Why We Believe in the Weaponization of Taxation. That's what it really should be titled. I mean, this stuff is so extraordinary.
Yeah.
Well, I gather that your position is that, okay, so I mean, I think there's at least two issues here, right? I mean, one would be whether there ought to be constitutional limits to taxation, but the second is that in considering the range of constitutional limits, to what extent should basic human rights matter? Would you agree that's a legitimate question, Laura?
Of course.
You want to comment on that?
If any right can be violated because it contributes to a country's revenue, or then the right doesn't exist. You can make up anything and channel it through a tax code, and that right no longer exists.
And Laura, I mean, doesn't the United States routinely make up anything and channel it through a tax code?
Even the IRS has at least one web page on the IRS explains that many laws are meant to either to influence behavior, to either encourage certain behaviors or discourage other behaviors. Of course, because people, you know, you need money to survive in the modern world. How do you motivate people to either do something or not do something? You touch their wallet. You threaten them with a tax if you want to discourage something, or you encourage them with a tax incentive if you want to encourage them to do something. This is why we talk about carbon taxes. We talk about credits for electric vehicles. That's exactly why.
And the denial of tax credits if you do business in countries that the American government doesn't like.
There you go. or if you have a retirement fund that the, you know, somewhere the U.S. doesn't want you to have it, we're going to penalize it. You're going to invest somewhere the U.S. doesn't want you to invest, we're going to penalize it. That's not about revenue. It's about discouraging behavior.
Absolutely. Absolutely correct. And
this
so
is why, this is why, just one more thing. This is why the whole discussion about whether changing these laws is revenue neutral or not is completely bogus. These laws aren't about collecting revenue. That's not what they're about.
Could you repeat that?
Which part? There's a fair amount of discussion about what.
But the laws are not about revenue.
The laws, and particular these laws about that are about taxing Americans who live overseas. They have never been about revenue. If you look at what in the 1860s and the 1890s, what were senators saying when they were defending these laws? They weren't saying we need the revenue. They were saying these people should not be going overseas. And so, you know, they should be paying these high taxes. And there was one senator who said, if anybody should be taxed, it should be the overseas Americans. Well, clearly that's not about revenue. Clearly that's about punishment and discouraging behavior. And by the way, leaving one's country is a human right. You should not be using taxes to discourage people from exercising a human right.
You know, I can't remember the exact context, but former Senator Moynihan once expressed outrage at the idea of the United States using its tax laws to enforce its immigration laws. I don't remember the exact context of it, but that was interesting. I mean, that was a clear recognition that, you know, just that, right? That these, I mean, maybe the better way to put it is that when it comes to tax laws, some of them are about raising revenue, but mostly they're about trying to influence, including punishment behavior. With Karen, do you think that's a more accurate statement of this?
Look, I think your very basic income tax is about revenue, you know, on wages, et cetera, earned in the U.S. But all of these extra things they've added, controlled foreign corporations, passive foreign investment companies, all of these things are all about incentivizing or disincentivizing particular behavior.
I would say that taxes at the state or local level are not about revenue, but they do have to tax for revenue at that level because they can't create money like the federal government can create money. The federal government can create money. It doesn't need to tax for revenue. If it's taxing income or for other, all of those, there's other reasons, but at a minimum, they would need to tax just to take money out of circulation. You can't keep putting money into circulation and not take money out, or you'd end up with crazy inflation. So for that reason alone, the United States needs to tax at a federal level in some way. The question is, how are they doing it? And what conditions are they doing it? Who is paying those taxes and how and why? But certainly you can make the case that no federal taxation is about revenue. It's always about something else.
It's interesting because the titles of these laws, right, you know, are so influential in how they're interpreted. So it's called the Internal Revenue Code. Okay. So maybe it includes that to some extent. But if you were trying to make up a title for Title 26 of U.S. laws today, currently called the Internal Revenue Code, what would you call it, Laura?
I never thought about that.
Think about it. Karen, you think about it too.
What would you call it, Don?
I think I would call it the Punishment and Hatred of Certain Categories of Persons Act. I mean, look at how many people, you know, certainly Americans abroad. I mean, you know, Professor Dorothy Brown, what was that book, The Whiteness of Wealth, you know, makes the case it discriminates against blacks. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on, how it gives favors, you know, to corporations. And one of the things that I'm really interested in is in the Moore case. You know, we put out this paper a couple weeks ago, Don't Blame the Victim, where, you know, part of what we're doing is we made the point that the number of individuals who are affected by the transition tax far exceeds the number of corporations, right? It's not even close. But yet the arguments before the Supreme Court never even mentioned individuals. And I think it'll be interesting to see if the judgment of the Supreme Court mentions individuals as well. What do you think?
And not only that, but the plaintiff or the appellate or whatever, I'm not sure what the title is, but Moore is about individual.
It's That's right. About. Moore is an individual. The Moore is an individual. Carbon life forms. You could see them. You could hear them. And they talked. Yet, that, you know, was, I mean, was that even discussed? Was it discussed?
Not at all. Not a discussion about how individuals are treated differently. You know, just not a discussion about the very different situation of the individuals living outside the U.S. as compared to the Moors who live in the U.S. It's as if they don't exist. They're just, the individuals are just subsumed into the corporation.
Well, I don't know if they're subsumed into the corporation. I think they don't exist at all. I mean, I think it will be fascinating because if this decision comes down without mentioning individuals, then I think that the next paper that Seed ought to write is something to the effect of how the Supreme Court has just confirmed that individuals are irrelevant in America. Sure. I mean, you know, absolutely. But Laura, you were at the hearing. Why didn't you raise your hand and say, excuse me, but the Moors are individuals. Why are we not talking about individuals? Why didn't you do that? I had always thought that your presence was there to, you know, to make that point.
Sure, I'd been thrown out before I'd gotten a word out.
Well, you haven't gotten the words out before you were thrown out. But I mean, think of it. It would have made the news. Laura Snyder, seat president, you know, raises the impossible. Could individuals matter in America today?
I assure you, people in the audience are not allowed to do anything that might disrupt or disturb.
You're not disrupting. You're educating. What do you think?
Well, I guess there was a moment. I'll tell you, though, there was a moment when the Solicitor General made that statement about, I don't remember the exact words anymore, but basically, you know, she either said outright or strongly implied that more corporations were affected than individuals. And I remember I heard that and just without thinking, I instinctively really made a face at that. Yeah. And I thought, and then I was like, oh no, I better not do that because even that could get me in trouble.
You would have become famous right there. First person in history thrown out of a Supreme Court hearing. Why? Raising the question of whether individual Americans matter. Would have been great. So what do you think, Karen? What do you think the Internal Revenue Code should be called?
I don't know. Monetary incentives and disincentives. Or
monetary incentives and disincentives and controlling the money supply.
Yeah.
Well, maybe what about just the Constitution of the United States?
Yeah. Okay.
No. I mean, I think there's a lot of truth, but, you know, there are no limits to the Internal Revenue Code. For everything else, there is the Constitution.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I mean, this has been a fun discussion, but actually, I think very serious. This is a very serious problem. Well, I assume you would agree this is a very serious problem, this peculiar status the tax code has in America.
Yeah, I think it's a big problem. And you know, the other side of it, so we're talking more about the deference side, but part of the argument as to why was that the court was not capable of understanding a tax case. So do you think that's true, Laura? Do you think the court is incapable of understanding a tax law? Is it too complex?
No, I think the court, if it wants to, is perfectly capable. I mean, you know, they can get people to help them understand things that it, okay, maybe some of the people on the court aren't that smart, but I think there's some smart people on the court. I think they're perfectly capable of understanding. Question is, how much do they want to understand? And I don't know that they're any more or less capable of understanding than any member of Congress is.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
I think there's two answers to this stuff. Okay, the first is that, you know, the composition of the Supreme Court under the Constitution, I think there's a certain latitude, right? And, you know, I think you might be able to have divisions of the court or something. So first of all, I think that it would be possible, you know, to have a division of the Supreme Court that was devoted to taxation and had a different group of judges, number one. But number two, I think that, you know, a comment or a suggestion that somehow tax is so complicated that, you know, normal judges can't understand it is a really ignorant statement, okay?
It's a real indictment of the tax code.
Well, I think, first of all, there's a difference between, you know, understanding the technicalities of how things are put together and understanding how they affect people. Like, even a dog knows whether he's been kicked deliberately or tripped over. And, you know, it's precisely because of the effects of these laws that I think that the courts ought to be paying attention to this stuff. And then they can say to the government, well, you know, I mean, that's just technically just so beautiful. We love it. We love it. But the effect of it is just so offensive that we're not going to have it. We're not going to have it.
I think that that's true. I would also say that I wouldn't automatically say that having a section of a Supreme Court that's devoted to tax issues is necessarily not the right thing. But I would be very cautious of that. And this is why. Because what I see going on in Congress now is you have the Joint Committee on Taxation and you have the Congressional Budget Office who, you know, control so much of what goes on in Congress. And there's so many laws, if not all the, well, it depends on whether the members of Congress are pushing for revenue neutrality or not. But you have all of these laws that are scored. And if by either the CBO or the JCT, and if it does not come back scored based on its budget effect, then probably that law is not going to be adopted. And there is no counterweight to the CBO and the JCT in Congress. There is no one evaluating laws based on how their violations of the Constitution, their violations of equal protection. There is no counterweight to that. And the JCT and the CBO, they have a mandate to consider whether a law violates or does not violate a constitution. Not part of their mandate. It's not part of their expertise. It's not part of their processes. They're not going to give a damn about those questions. It's just it's not what they're there for. And if you were to give these questions to a tax section of the Supreme Court, again, I'd be very wary because, you know, they would potentially also be inclined to prioritize the tax and minimize all the other consequences of the law.
Oh my God. You know what? I just had a really radical idea. I've never even heard of anybody suggesting this before, but maybe, just maybe, tax laws ought to be held to the same standards as other laws.
That's pretty radical, John.
It is for America, isn't it?
And when you think that, you know, for a long time, there was no income tax in the U.S., how did it get to be now you can't even conceive of yourself as an American outside of the income tax system?
America, where taxation reigns supreme. Well, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, this working paper number 11, I think this is a really, really important paper. In some ways, it may be the most important one, right? Because it really gets back to ground zero. You know, should these people really be able to do anything they want? I gather, Laura, you think the answer is that they shouldn't.
That's definitely my opinion.
Karen, would that be your opinion too?
Yeah, I think we have human rights and constitutional rights for a reason, and that tax laws should not be able to violate those laws, those rights.
Oh, that is one of the most subversive statements I've ever heard.
Sorry.
Not enough people will listen to the podcast for it to get too widely distributed. But, you know, basically, at a bare minimum, and this stuff affects Americans abroad far more than any other group. So, you know, as we come to the end of the podcast here, Laura, do you think that the United States ought to be extending its tax laws extraterritorially?
Absolutely not.
Karen, what do you think?
Stop extraterritorial American taxation now.
And you'll find it at seatnow.org. That's where you need to go to find this stuff. Wonderful. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Karen. And we will be
back. Thank you, John.
Paper number 12.